in D.C., both on Monday the 26th and Tuesday the 27th. We will have live broadcasts from the Radio Row, kindly put together by family, our friends at Families USA, up on Capitol Hill to coincide with the arguments that will be taking place regarding the Affordable Care Act, which I would like very much to have survive constitutional scrutiny, but I also recognize how frighteningly difficult that may be given the rats who inhabit the Supreme Court. You know the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. Rats. With, in particular, the conflict of interest inherent in the participation of Justice Slappy Thomas, whose wife made beaucoup de money from her advocacy against the very self-same Affordable Care Act as part of some right-wing revolting teabagging outfit. Nah, that's not going to have any impact on his decision. No, of course not. No. The fact that he's going to go home and, you voted in favor of what? After I have spent all that time getting all of these ignorant, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, the slobber-licking right-wing freaks into a hot lather over Obamacare, and you voted to let it get through, Clarence! You can just, no, you don't get the couch tonight, Slappy. You can take your Coke can and your corn stash and sleep out in the shed. No. Her participation and significant remuneration from, the baggers and the pence of the Affordable Care Act, that won't have bearing whatsoever on his decision. And anybody who believes that needs to sit down. I know it's not the right time of year or anything, but needs to sit down with, how about Miracle on 47th Street? Is it 47th, 43rd, 41st? The one with the little Natalie Wood in it. And Maureen O'Hara. And that guy, that guy that nobody remembers was the male lead. But William Frawley was in that movie. He had a bit role that is actually salient to this conversation. William Frawley in Miracle on... Oh, come on, somebody help me. Miracle on... Was it 47th? Until I get some help, I'm going to feel really funny here. Yeah, Jesus, we're buffering like crazy. Hopefully it'll settle down. Anyway, the Miracle Christmas show. Tim Frawley, who went on to play Fred Murray in the I Love program, plays the political hack who advises the judge who is hearing the case against Santa Claus. Oh, okay. See, I was off by a complete the factor of 10. Thank you, Marty. Miracle on 34th Street. Thank you. You don't know what it means to have you guys ready at the nearest flub for a little help. Miracle on 34th Street. Thank you. I wonder why the brain cell that was on went and died. Well, I'll miss you. But he's the political, William Frawley is the political officer who advised the judge who is hearing the suit on whether there's a Santa Claus. And there's a very famous and very humorous scene in which William Frawley, chomping his cigar, because way back then you could enjoy a cigar in a courthouse. Those civilized days are over. Says to the judge, oh, sure, you go ahead. You go ahead, Your Honor. You rule that there's no Santa Claus. You do that. You're going to break hearts across the country. And by the way, Mr. Macy and Mr. Gimbels are going to be real happy with you next time you think about running for re-election. Look, it's a reality. Judges are political creatures, whether they are appointed or elected. You know, later in the movie, the judge goes home, and his own children won't speak to him, or his grandchildren, or whatever, because he's put Santa Claus on trial. And his own wife is none too happy with him, either. Now, I know it's not Santa Claus that's on trial here. It is something far more substantial, frankly. It is and I know because I speak from experience. I speak from reality. It is the fundamental ability of people who need to go to the doctor when they're sick, and when they're not sick, you know, preventive care, to be able to do that. And one man whose wife has a distinct financial interest in having the law overturned, who has been paid to argue countless times, who has been paid to whip those knuckle-walking, spit-licking, drooling, right-wing asshats into a frenzy. Yeah, she's not going to take too kindly to it if her Clarence rules, votes in favor of upholding it. There's an interesting little tool that came out yesterday. I got an email about it. It is at, and please, none of the emails about how he's just the same as Hitler or Bush the Darker or any of that other horse crap. BarackObama.com. There is a healthcare app that talks about what the Affordable Care Act does. Learn how the Affordable Care Act benefits you. And it's just a matter of clicking boxes. One, what is your insurance status? So, for instance, I would click, I have no insurance. By 2014, which means I've just got to stay, I guess not healthy, but, you know, ambulatory till 2014. And I have a better understanding now of why that is than before. But if I can just stay ambulatory till 2014, I can get coverage. By 2014, the Affordable Care Act will help nearly all uninsured Americans get coverage. If you have a pre-existing condition, you can even get coverage through the new pre-existing condition insurance plan. There's an online insurance finder, all kinds of stuff. So, all right, click next. What is your gender? Well, I'm a guy. Starting in 2014, insurance companies won't be able to charge more or deny coverage based on a pre-existing condition like heart disease, which many men suffer, even though more women die from heart disease in the world today than men. Just say it. How many people are in your household? Okay, then me, Agnes, Marky, Ferg, Doodle. Five. What's your income? What's your household income? Under $36,000? Oh, yeah, we can click that. Starting in 2014, you'll qualify for Medicaid in your state, so you and your family will have access to affordable health insurance. Howdy-do. Won't that be nice? Because, see, that's one of the things that sets us apart from other, perhaps other operations. This is a broadcast done by the working poor. We are. You know, I told you the story some time back about, but won't it be nice? Under 36,000? Let's back up for a minute. Let's see what those numbers, let's say, okay, between 36,000 and 108,000, what happens? Well, that's tax credits. To shop for insurance in the Affordable Insurance Exchange. But the big deal, and those tax credits save up to 60% on premiums. The big deal is the Medicaid. Or at least it is for me. And it will be for many of the listeners in this audience. Because right now, Medicaid is asset tested. Like I said, I told you some time back about the car wreck that Agnes was involved in when one of our local aficionados of synthetic narcotics rammed into the back of my rusty red pickup truck while Agnes was sitting waiting to turn left onto our road. Ferg was with her. They were both wearing their seatbelts, and they were still both hurt. The rusty red pickup truck literally saved their lives. I think I recall one evening offering a sort of valedictory to the rusty red pickup truck, which I still miss, and will probably never see its like again. But as a result of the local pillheads having destroyed my truck, they paid off, and this is a 16-year-old, and I mean rusty, red pickup truck. They paid off what little value it had, which weren't much. But the value of that truck was sufficient under present rules to make me too wealthy to have health insurance. And you can look it up. It was a 1995 Dodge pickup truck with 140,000 miles on it. And the payout on that made me too wealthy for public health insurance. No kidding. Really. Well, all that goes away if the Affordable Care Act passes. And wouldn't it be nice? So it is the arguments surrounding the Affordable Care Act that we will be covering on Monday and Tuesday of next week on Capitol Hill. And I'm here to tell you, it's gonna be a zoo. Americans for Prosperity, that AstroTurf group that Dick Armey put together, him and his pals. I don't know why they don't just call it the Dick Armey. Are bringing in, at vast corporate expenses from... with help from people like the Koch brothers, some 50 busloads of pissed off, ignorant, knuckle walking, mouth breathing, dumber than homemade dirt Americans to let that Muslim Kenyan in the white higher White House with the deep-seated hatred of white people and a distinct anti-colonialist tendency, to let him know that we don't want no government health care because we don't want to be socialists or communists or whatever it is that being able to the God doctor will make us. Right? Right. How many people do those big old tour scenic cruisers carry? 60? So what, 3,000 people? Morans. Get a brain, morans. And of all the groups that I've been seeing, because I get the press releases every day, of all the groups that I've been seeing are going to be there, there's one in particular that's my favorite. The 60 Plus Association. I have no idea what their website is, don't ask. But the 60 Plus Association is comprised of people, it's, again, AstroTurf. Its membership has been recruited from among the slobber lickers. People in advance of 60 years of age, sexagenarians, who are coming to Capitol Hill to tell that Kenyan to keep his hands, keep his government hands off our health care. They don't want no government health care. They want their Medicare just the way it's always been, but they don't want no government health care. Glory. Praise. Hallelujah. Yeah, Dr. John. 50 busloads of baggers? Damn, that's a bunch of empty Walmarts. It is indeed. No cleanup in Action Alley. Nobody here. I mean, what a bunch of spit swizzlers. Yeah, I'm good. Rick Smith, our colleague, will be broadcasting with us on the first day, but he can't be there for the second. And with me not having to be on the air till about noon, I'm strongly tempted to take a little saunter with some video equipment and maybe a little bit of highfalutin this and that, and capture some video of some teabaggers, you know, in the wild. I was thinking about sending Ferg out to do that, but no, like I told you the last time, after having him last week look over and go, Daddy, can I go over and engage the religious weirdo in conversation? No! No, I think he'll have to be escorted. I'm pretty sure. So again, that's where we're going to be. Then Wednesday would be a drive day home, or Thursday would be a drive day home. But we've got a lot of stuff brewing out there in the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign, and since we're going to be in D.C. anyway, I figure to get some work done, take some meetings, tell some more people who may not know that we're being poisoned here in Appalachia. You know, for money, for profit. Poisoned for profit. Just laid back over that altar to unholy profit and having poison poured in us until we die, so that Kevin Crutchfield, the CEO of Alpha Natural Resources, who is still paying bennies to the former CEO of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, can have more millions. Because they figured out a secret way to hitch a U-Haul to a hearse and make it count. Once they're dead. So that work will probably take place either Wednesday or Wednesday and Thursday. I'll be home either Thursday for a show, either Thursday or Friday. Okay? God almighty, it's taken me 22 minutes to do a show announcement about what next week's schedule is? And you wonder why we operate without commercials. So that's what next week looks like. Another reminder, we have a Prism West Virginia American History broadcast, a chat session coming up with Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly this Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I hope you'll join us. There is no better way to learn American history than from these two profoundly intelligent individuals. Yeah, I got a little piece of audio here. From a teabag in Arizona weirdo. Oh, where'd she go? Dadgummit, I had the audio of her reading her 4th of July message. Her name is Representative Terry Proud. She's a re-pig licking in Arizona. And she put out this truly bizarre message where she's holding a really big notebook and reading from it as though it was her bat mitzvah or something, and it was in a notebook instead of a scroll. Only the filth that she's reading is not scriptural. It's just made-up American history weirdness. She got herself into the news, Representative Terry Proud did, with the following statement that she recently made in regard to women's health care. She said, personally, I'd like to make a law that mandates a woman watch an abortion being performed prior to having a surgical procedure. If it's not a life, it shouldn't matter. If it doesn't harm a woman, then she shouldn't care. And don't we want more transparency and education in the medical profession anyway? We demand it everywhere else. Until the dead child can tell me that he does not feel any pain, I have no intentions of clearing the conscience of the living. I will be voting yes. Oh, Margaret, get a net. This is the same woman who, in addition to reading from weirdness, out-of-context historical remarks by, well, I'm sure she thinks that Thomas Jefferson was a good Episcopal, you know? No, she also sponsored a bill in Arizona that would require the Bible to be taught as an elective in high school.
But not the Quran, because the Quran hasn't influenced Western culture the way the Bible has. We put so much fear around any discussion of the Bible that I think it's really causing our kids to miss out. Can't we say the same thing about the Quran? Guess not.
But Terry Proud is one of those people who makes up American history as she goes along, and there's nothing like loading up your BS detector by hanging out for a couple of hours and watching or listening to Dr. Bill and Professor Keith as they lay out the straight skinny of how America went about being founded. That's 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, noon to 2 Pacific, this coming Saturday. And I hope you'll join in. Oh, see, Dr. John, you think just like me. Yes, fake interviews. Talking about going down amongst the baggers in D.C. Tell them you're from Head On Ministries Radio and just let them spout. Better than The Daily Show. Morans in the Wild. God, I'll have to get my safari jacket out. I'll feel like Marlon Perkins.
Well, I tell you about the latest insurance products from Mutual of Omaha. My pal Jim over here is being mauled by a wild cheetah.
Oh, I like that a lot. I think we'll... Stealth. Oh, that speaks to me. Now... I got to tell you, I can't so much as step out of the house without interesting things happening. Or at least things that my family thinks is interesting. We headed down the mountain today because Doodle, who no longer has wisdom teeth, and Ferg, who recently had his removed, each had appointments down in the valley. No, I'm not going to sing down in the valley. But because she's been having a hard, you know, she really can't eat food right now. And you get really cranky when you get hungry like that. I, I remember. So I innocuously, because they've modified the menu a little bit, it's not like I want to eat there every day, but I innocuously pulled in to the Golden Arches. Because I thought, hey, they've got smoothies in there now, and my doodle could have a smoothie. And Agnes said, Bob, that's a great idea. Do that. I'd like a smoothie, too. And Ferg, manly man that he is, said, Dad, I'll have a cup of decaf. You can at least get a decent decaf on the road at Mickey D's, as long as you're not burning yourself with it. Ugh, the story still makes me crazy. Woman had third-degree burns and right-wing bladder had gas bags like Flush Limbaugh made fun of her. Nope. So, Marty, you keep making these assumptions about me living in civilization and stuff. No, we have no Jamba Juice. We don't even have Papaya King. Hell, we don't have Orange Julius. I love Orange Julius. No, but McDonald's has smoothies. I'll tell you a little secret. The mango pineapple smoothies with a little bit of rum in them. Good and good for you. But I stopped and walked in there, and so there was an order of one wild berry smoothie, one strawberry banana smoothie, and one mango pineapple smoothie. Doodle wanted the mango pineapple. Isn't it amazing you can get that at McDonald's now? This is not an ad for McDonald's. I would not advocate eating any meat that comes out of that place, and if I actually sat and read the ingredients list of their smoothies, it's probably just one great big honking big wad bottle full of high fructose corn syrup, so don't ruin it for me yet, okay? So they got the first one made, the mango pineapple, and then they got the wild berry smoothie made, and then the woman looked around and said, we're out of strawberry banana stuff, and we don't have any in the back. No, Marty, McDonald's does not have rum. That's what the little airline bottles are for. And you don't do that anyway, because you don't want to be driving like that. You take it home with you. This is not Louisiana where there are daiquiri drive-thrus. So we got down to the last. We're out of the strawberry banana smoothie goo. We ain't got none in the back neither. I said that's fine. Just make it another wild berry smoothie. And the woman looked at me as though. And it made me wonder what kind of clientele she deals with, what kinds of customers. She looked at me like she expected me to tear her head off. She said, really? Really? Wildberry will be fine. Well, she said, well, that's wonderful. I said, I'm sure it'll be delicious. She said, we're sorry. I said, you've no reason to apologize. And she was just thunderstruck. But then, long about then, the things that they make the smoothies with are these great. I mean, they probably have more computer processing power in them than the computers we used to go to the moon in the late 60s. Now, see, Marty, you've started something. No, Jim, no Pellegrino either.
I prefer Perrier, thank you very much.
But there's more computer processing power in these smoothie machines, and they probably cost $15,000 a piece. And they have to be that way so that they can be easy to use. And easy to understand. They send, like when something goes wrong, they don't, you know, a message doesn't scroll across the little micro screen for you to read. It gives you pictures. Really. And so after apologizing profusely to me for being out of strawberry banana goo, the next thing I heard was, uh-oh. And, you know, the uh-oh in the Smithers, West Virginia McDonald's is never good. Was that a good uh-oh? Have you ever heard a good uh-oh, Bob? And so this guy comes along with a big bucket of ice, and they take the top off of it. That is the, on there the same. It's just a little plastic, big plastic lid of a big plastic ice bin. And he pours the ice in, and they put the lid back on, and proceed to sit there. And at one point, I hear the phrase, "That pitcher won't go away, and it won't let me make his smoothie." Like a Star Trek episode. No, it was like 2001, really. With the smoothie machine standing in as the monolith. I don't know. Maybe I should get Ferg in here. He was standing there. I didn't think he was going to make it out under his own power once it was all was said and done. Stood there patiently. Yeah, we were going to be late for our appointment. Stood there patiently watching as they tried to put the lid back on. Just a, you know, this isn't about them. This is about, you know, just another day in my life. My father used to have a law of the universe that was proven on a number of occasions, most frequently when he would buy a new automobile. He said, if there is a broke down, messed up, jack leg, rejected piece of anything out there, it's sitting on a shelf waiting for me to go buy it. Apparently Dad was with us today. It's a big, round, clear plastic bin that holds the ice on top of the smoothie monolith. And they kept turning the lid. You got to line up them two little lines so the picture will go away, so the machine will let me make his smoothie. And I'm saying nothing. I'm quiet. You know, Sam Kennison would have been having a hissy by then. But I'm just kind of pulling back and being Marlon Perkins about it all. That's what reminded me mentioning Marlon Perkins. And they turn the lid a little this way, and they turn the lid a little this way. No, picture ain't gone away. And they call the manager up. And she turned it a little this way, and it turned it a little that way. And that's when I noticed that one part of the lid that fit down over the basin that was already broken out, because it had probably been, I don't know, dropped or perhaps punched for being uncooperative. And there was this tab. It's not actually a tab, it's a handle. It's the kind of thing that engineers put on molded plastic things to indicate lift by this. And it was all the way at the back end of the smoothie thing. And I am a sweet and gentle individual. I really do. I try to do unto others as I would have them do unto me, even though I don't follow any particular religious creed. That just seems like good advice. Probably proven by the fact that the same admonition is contained in just about every creed the world over. It's like how to get from here to there. Don't go through life being crappy to people. Now, see, Marty, you're thinking of malfunctioning replicators. When I said it's like a Star Trek episode, I was thinking about that jungle planet with the bleach blonde people running around in the lavas, who were afraid that they would anger Crawl or whatever that turned out to be a malfunctioning computer inside a volcano. That's the episode I was thinking of. And so as I sat there watching this comedy of the lid and the picture that wouldn't go away, I finally said, I think if you take the lid off and you bring this handle around that you use to take the lid off with, I think if you line that up in front, the picture will go away and you can make my smoothie. I wasn't ugly. I wasn't hateful. I was nice. And they looked at each other. And they said, and you could see that the thoughts processing and passing one to the other, and the one says to the manager, should we try it? And the manager says, we ain't got nothing to lose by trying it. Try it. So then the lady who said, should we try it, to the manager, and the manager said, try it. The lady that was wanting to, that said, should we try it, was too short to reach the lid, so she turned around to the guy with the tattoo on his forehead and said, put it on there like the man done said. And he said, well, all right. Because, you know, I'm just one of those stupid customers. What could I possibly know about the intricacies of pleasing the smoothie monolith so that the picture would go away and it would let them make smoothies again? And he took it all the way off, because it's got a handle in the center. He took it all the way off, turned it all the way around, gave that handle a good eyeballing. Jesus, I'm telling you, at this point in time, Ferg was... He had turned his back, Ferg had, because he was rendered at this point almost helpless. I mean, this is just the crazy kind of crap that happens to us trying to get a stinking smoothie because my daughter can't eat solid food right now. But he inspects it and looks at it and kind of flicks the little handle thing with his thumb. Kind of makes a think noise, you know, like clear, hard plastic does. And sets it up there and puts the lid back on and makes sure that the little lines line up. And the little short lady who couldn't reach the lid looks at the manager and says, the picture went away. We can make the smoothie now. And they all three turned and looked at me. And the little lady looked at the manager and said, he knew how to fix the smoothie machine. I am not kidding you. Ferg, at this point, is purple. And thanks to the fact that I've tried to show my son some classic films, they were apparently racing through his mind, because as quickly as they got this... How did you, and then, I mean, this was the capper. How did you know to do that? How do you answer that? I said, just lucky, I guess. Because anything else wouldn't have suited. The man made the smoothie machine make smoothies again. So we take our two wildberry smoothies and our one pineapple mango. And at this point in time, I'm thinking of heading back up the road to the Rite Aid for a couple of those little airline bottles of rum, but I'm driving and I can't do that. And we get in the car, and Ferg collapses. He's done.
He couldn't breathe. He manages to hand the pineapple mango smoothie over to Doodle. And I've
got the one wild berry, and he hands the other one to his mother. And the first words out of his mouth were, "Oh my God, mother, it was like 2001. It was like Quest for Fire." And I thought he wasn't even paying attention when I showed him those films. 2001 can be a bit dull, you know.
And then proceeds to recount the whole thing to my wide-eyed, disbelieving, mouth-hanging-agape wife, who, when she is able to finally collect her composure, turns as seriously to me as she possibly can and says, "Bob Kincaid, you are the smoothie whisperer."
Which set off another round for everybody but Doodle, who was just... Doodle's just not home right now because of the whole thing.
And the vehicle descended into chaos once again. That was my morning. Bob Kincaid, smoothie whisperer.
Okay, so tell me again about the hash part.
Okay, what you want to know?
Hash is legal, right?
Yeah, it's legal, but he's 100% legal. I mean, he just can't walk into a restaurant, roll the joint, and start puffing away. I mean, they want you to smoke in your home or certain designated places.
No, there has been.
Yeah, it breaks down like this. Okay, it's legal to buy it. It's legal to own it. And if you're the proprietor of a hash bar, it's legal to sell it. It's legal to carry it, but that doesn't matter. Just get a load of this, all right? If you get stopped by a cop in Amsterdam, it's illegal for them to search you. I mean, that's the right the cops in Amsterdam don't have.
Oh, man, I'm going. That's all there is to it. I'm fucking going.
No, baby, you dig it the most. But you know what the funniest thing about Europe is?
What?
It's a little differences. I mean, they got the same shit over there that they got here, but it's just there, it's a little different.
Example.
All right, well, you can walk into a movie theater in Amsterdam and buy a beer. And I don't mean just like an old paper cup. I'm talking about a glass of beer. And in Paris, you can buy a beer at McDonald's. And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
I mean, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know what the fuck a quarter pounder is.
What do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Well, Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
Thank you.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, March 22nd, 2012.
So today, I've come to Cushing, an oil town.
The zombie Keystone Pipeline rises again. Obama fast-tracks the southern leg.
We've got two major problems that are easier to solve together than separately.
The wax man cometh with a deficit-cutting carbon tax, while Republicans protect big oil's billion-dollar subsidies. The Exxon Valdez headed for the scrap heap of history, plus... It's World Water Day. Do you know where your clean water is?
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Jackass, folks. We're just dealing with a jackass.
Oh, Rush, don't be so hard on yourself. This is your Green News Report, Jackass. Okay, Des, over the last week or two, we have been tracking the weather in my old hometown of St. Louis, and I'm here to report that this week, we broke a record. 9 days of temperatures over 80 degrees in March. March, by the way, is the month when we have the largest snowstorms of the year, but not this year.
This year, it is an historic heat event across the U.S., just how historic has yet to be determined.
Now, I should also add, however, the previous record, 8 days over 80, was in 1910, thus disproving your entire global warming theory hooey.
Not a chance. You know, it really does. It depends on context. This is not just one record in one place, but thousands of records all at once falling across the nation of this type of duration.
Oh, you and your science and your data. All right, what do you have for us today?
Well, Thursday of this week marks World Water Day. Nearly 3 billion people in the world right now face water shortages and lack of access to safe drinking water, and that's projected to get worse with climate change.
What climate change?
For example, the historic Texas drought right now has already cost farmers and ranchers over $7 billion in 2011 alone. The World Economic Forum lists water shortages as one of the top five risks to society, ranked right up there with global economic collapse. Meanwhile, water experts say the U.S. could create 2 million jobs in the U.S. and add hundreds of billions to the economy by upgrading our water infrastructure. Understand your water. We have the links at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
As long as I'm president, we will not walk away from the promise of clean energy.
That was President Obama on Wednesday at the nation's largest solar facility in Nevada on a tour of four swing states to promote what he calls an all-of-the-above energy strategy, which includes solar, wind, and oil. Obama mocked Republican attacks on American clean energy. And in fact, the new GOP budget proposal from Republican House member Paul Ryan of Wisconsin practically eliminates all federal funding for clean energy and instead proposes a fire sale of millions of acres of public lands to private interests, all while keeping in place $4 billion in taxpayer subsidies that are given to big oil every year.
And that's actually $40 billion over the next 10 years, according to the Ryan budget.
But big oil is happy that President Obama is also focused on oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, on Thursday, when he announced that the administration would fast-track the permitting of just the southern portion of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline that would carry crude oil from Cushing, Oklahoma, to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast, where it would be shipped overseas.
And today I'm directing my administration to cut through the red tape, break through the bureaucratic hurdles, and make this project a priority. to go ahead and get it done.
Well, he's really playing all sides of this one, isn't he?
That's what he means when he says all of the above. Congressional Republicans, of course, panned the decision, calling it, quote, meaningless and not enough. While the Paul Ryan budget proposal continues big subsidies to big oil, Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman of California has proposed a different deficit-cutting tool, requiring polluting corporations to pay to pollute with a carbon tax, which would also pay off the debt and solve several of the country's problems. Waxman and former Republican Congressman Wayne Gilchrist proposed the carbon tax at an event sponsored by the Center for American Progress. Like the carbon tax that is already underway in Australia, a carbon tax on America's biggest corporate polluters would generate an estimated $250 billion in revenue every year, which would be rebated to consumers, with the rest going to pay down the national debt.
So Republicans have already killed their own idea of cap and trade, and now you think they're going to go ahead with a carbon tax?
Not likely, as long as the oil and gas industry continues to give 90% of its political contributions to Republicans.
Well, it's a good thought anyway.
Finally, the infamous Exxon Valdez oil tanker is headed for the scrap heap, literally. It is the same oil tanker that was involved in the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the nation's second largest oil spill back in 1989, that dumped 11 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound in Alaska. Exxon is still fighting in court to avoid paying damages. That ship, though, is history.
For much more on all of our stories today and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider sponsoring the Green News Report to help us stay afloat, unlike the Exxon Valdez. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, stuff for my dog.
Holy crap. There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And don't forget about that body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
About 2.5 minutes before the hour, we're going to get an extra 2.5 minutes of programming. No, it doesn't quite work that way, does it? A couple of emails rolling in. Jim asking, did Schiller's Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth start in the background? You know, the moment when he made the smoothie machine picture go away and the smoothie machine worked again? It almost felt like it did. Under the heading of smoothie kerfuffle, Dr. John writes, oh my God, it's like striking a match in front of a caveman. It's like doing card tricks for a dog. Oh. And then this from Tim in L.A. Bob, are you exaggerating the accents and naivete of the McDonald's employees? I don't know that it was naivete, and I'm not exaggerating the accents, but no, there was no exaggeration in there. Actually, the whole thing took longer than it took me to tell. No kidding. Tim continues, funny thing, it's the same thing here in Los Angeles, but the accent is Spanglish. It's really depressing that the quality of employees at McDonald's are equal around all 50 states. But if you want to have fun, ask the cashier, do you accept Hawaiian money? Is this what you do? Is this what you do with your free time, Tim? Really? Ask the cashier, do you accept Hawaiian money? Every time I ask this, they say, no, not once in my life, not once in my life, asking this question, have I heard the word yes? and these people are cooking our food. And I want you to understand, please, this is not a commentary on working people. It is not. It is a commentary on the way corporate America treats working people. It's a commentary on the way we educate people in this country. You see, inherent in the educational process is a determination that, well, we don't need to have no art classes. We don't need no journalism. We don't need no high school paper. If they graduate, they can get a job at McDonald's, and if they don't graduate, they can go to work for the coal company. That's the attitude here where I am. That's the little manger wherein incubates the anti-intellectualism that permeates this society today. Well, keep your government hands off my Medicare, because I'm from the 60 Plus Association. Where's my Ralston? That's how you get there. That's why Albert and I have these back and forth the inside baseball references to a film I trust you've all seen by now, Idiocracy, where the woman who does the intake at the hospital has a series of pictures that she pushes depending on what it is that is the ailment of the patient in front of her, because literacy is gone. That's where that all comes from. Going back to, what was her name again? Oh, I've lost her. That idiot bagger in Arizona who wants all women to have to watch a movie of a baby being pulled out of a woman and killed in an abortion. Michael wrote in and he said, so Bob, this pro-life person from Arizona is explicitly and unequivocally pro-abortion then, right? Did I hear this right? She's pro at least one abortion done for show, you know, for the video that the women have to watch. Yeah, because that wouldn't count if it was just if they was just pulling a Barbie out of there or something. It's gotta die so others may live. Oh, a very, very, very trenchant observation, Michael. Maybe a few extra dead fetuses to get the right take. Ah, the lighting was wrong. See if you can get it with its mouth open looking like it's going to scream. Don't worry, we can loop the scream in with the Foley editor. Or are these live performances that the women have to watch? If so, the dead fetuses are really going to start to pile up. I mean, we lefties sometimes say that no one's really pro-abortion, we're just pro-choice. I guess that concept needs to be amended now. No kidding. Dr. John says, exactly, Bob. We rob kids of critical thinking skills in school, set them in wildly regimented jobs, and train them to push buttons. I feel sympathy and compassion for the workers you mentioned, not superiority. Oh, I feel no sense of superiority whatsoever, Dr. John. Because, you know what? I couldn't make it a day in McDonald's. And I know it. I'd hit somebody. Because the thing that probably had the most lasting effect on me, or made the most profound impression, was when this sweet little lady who was just making my smoothies looked at me like she expected me to come across the counter when I told her that we were out, that they were, when she told me that they were out of strawberry banana goo. I just felt bad when I said, well, that's all right. No need to apologize. Wildberry will be fine. Really?
yeah. It's, and I said, it's not your fault. She said, well, I guess kind of it is because I sold you one. Which just makes me wonder what the management must be like. You know, not at the floor manager level, but the next layer up.
What do you mean you sold him a strawberry banana smoothie? Didn't you see on the cash register that said we're out of the strawberry banana goo? One more of those and you'll hit the bricks, honey.
That's maybe one thing you left out, John. Fear. And we keep coming back to fear, don't we? A long time ago, I made reference to the fact that this is the coward nation. And I remember, because I think I first said it when I was still on terrestrial radio in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, West Virginia. And I referred to the coward nation. And, of course, the little wingnuts, as soon as they got the drool wiped away from the mouthpiece. How dare you call our great America cowards? You're unpaid. You're Baghdad Bob. You know what? Your name ought to be Bob Al-Kincaida. That's who you are. Don't love Jeebus. Jim could probably verify some of this for you. He heard it. And that's when I explained, no, Murgatroyd. Coward Nation. COWERED. As if we are cowering. As if we are huddled up in a corner squatting with a look on our face like a dog trying to pass a peach pit. Because we are! This nation is scared of everything. And we have the Repiglican Party to thank for it. Ray sent me a quote that sounds pretty much like it's a real quote. I didn't feel the urge to run over and Snopes it. A quote from Barry Goldwater, who was a crazy right-winger. You know, that kind. But Barry Goldwater said, mark my word, if and when these preachers get control of the Republican Party, and they're sure trying to do so, it's going to be a terrible damn problem. Frankly, these people frighten me. Politics and governing demand compromise, but these Christians believe they are acting in the name of God, so they can't and won't compromise. I know. I've tried to deal with them. And this brand of Republican has nothing but fear to offer. Where FDR told a nervous nation, all we have to fear is fear itself, the Republican Party in 2012 would say, all we have is fear. And it's in evidence everywhere. It's in these godforsaken stand your ground laws that get little black boys blown away by a tremulous gun-packing patriot. It's everywhere. It's in the fear of working people to organize and sign cards. And vote in favor of organization in the workplace because they're afraid their job will go away because that's what they've told them. You know, you stand up for yourself and you're gone, buddy. You can be replaced. It's not like we got to have just a hell of a lot of skills to teach somebody to work at a McDonald's, sister. Best be careful about selling them strawberry banana smoothies when you know damn good and well there ain't no strawberry banana goo.
fear. Nothing but fear. In Georgia, fear. Where a young man named Reuben Lack ran for and won the election for student body president at Alpharetta High School. You know, when you're student body president, it looks good on your going to college resume and stuff, but most of the time the student body president doesn't try to do a heck of a lot. Well, Reuben Lack broke the mold. He did try to do something. What he tried to do was have a prom that would be inclusive. That instead of having a prom king and a prom queen, that they would have a prom court. And he felt like he really had something that had some moral starch behind it, so he wouldn't let go of it. And he mentioned the idea enough times to get the faculty advisors to whatever the student governing body was to unilaterally remove him as president of the student body that had been elected by the students themselves. You know, more high school students vote in their student body elections than Americans vote in our political elections. I mean, this really was disenfranchisement. The teachers and the faculty advisors got downright perturbed with Reuben Lack, seeing as how he was going to make it possible for them sickening, disgusting, hell-bound homos to maybe actually feel like they weren't complete outcasts in the high school and get to go to the stupid dance. Jesus, I remember the high school I grew up in was presided over by a member of the Church of Christ. I've told this story before. We weren't allowed to even have a prom because that man's religious tenets demanded that there be no dancing within his bailiwick, and he deemed the public school that I attended to be his personal fiefdom. So we had a junior-senior banquet. And then everybody had to retire out to this wealthy family's barn to do our dancing off school property and out of the sight of Almighty God. It's the same thing. Fear. Fear that God will see you. Fear that young gay boys and young lesbian women might drink some punch and have a memorable evening to look back upon as they age? Or perhaps fear that the prom court and as a consequence that the whole facade of Southern genteel hypocrisy would be ripped off in Alpharetta, Georgia, for everyone to see. I don't know. Fear. It's what's for dinner. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John from upstate New York. How are you?
John, how are you?
I'm doing great. Listen, I wasn't actually planning to call, but I really think you've hit on something profound with this fear talk that you just brought up, and I'd kind of like to maybe unpack that a bit right after I give you the climate change report from the Finger Lakes region of New York.
Oh, do please.
Do that. Yeah, let me just tell you, it's mid to late March. I'm sitting on my porch, and it was approaching 80 degrees today. It was our ninth day in a row of record-breaking temperatures. We're about 35 degrees above normal, and we have been for a while. And I know, you know, weather's not climate, et cetera, but weird weather is climate change, and that's what we're having. And it's just, it's crazy up here. There's daffodils up, and I've never seen that. the time we've been here.
They and see, this is just the weirdness marching north, John, because our jonquils came up in mid-February.
That's outrageous.
And the stuff, you know, the stuff that's really telling is the stuff that really doesn't have the hand of man about it. Here in the hills and hollers, we deem ramps to be a precious thing, and I won't interrupt our discussion with a discourse on what the hill's a ramp.
Is that like a wild leek, same thing?
It's like a wild leek, wild garlic, but it's kind of broadleaf, and it is pungent in the extreme. Garlic and leeks run from ramps.
Okay.
I mean, it's the wild bull elephant of the early forest floor, and it's the first sign of spring. Usually, you can go into the hills even with, you know, snow on the ground, and along about now, you'll start to see the ramps poking their heads up through the snow because they can tolerate it.
Okay.
And everybody goes, ramps! And goes out and gathers, and you have ramps and beans and ramps and eggs, and it's a tonic. It's really, really good for you. It's all the stuff in garlic that's good for you is in a ramp and then some. And we go a little crazy over our ramps for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't cultivate them, and you don't plant them, and you don't seed them. They're just native to Appalachia. And those things were up not... I mean, they should just now be coming up. And they were out a month ago.
Wow. That's crazy. That's ridiculous. I think we're talking about the same thing. Actually, I think the site I dug a couple of years back had those growing all over, and one of the guys on the crew... pulled a couple out of the ground, and I think he sort of cooked them with his cigarette lighter and had them for lunch one day. I think we're talking about the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've never roasted a ramp with a cigarette lighter, but now I have a mission.
There you go. But, you know, this ties into the fear thing, too, and I'm gonna diverge there, and it sounds like an awful topic, but it's important to talk about. I think the thing is, it's not just fear, it's misdirected fear, and I think that there's like a, I think I've seen a psychological term for this, that we're afraid of the stuff that's really visible and seems really threatening while we minimize the threat for the stuff that is really dangerous to us. And this, you know, climate change is one thing. It's like you don't really see it, but it's there and it's happening and it poses a really like existential threat. But we are much more afraid of, like you were talking about, you know, oh, having gay kids in the prom, and we're afraid of the threatening black man walking down the street next to us. You know, I think that's what I'm talking about, and that's what I mean when I say that the fear is misplaced. We're trained to be afraid of things that aren't a threat, and we're trained to not look at the stuff that is. Does that make any sense?
It's classic misdirection, because otherwise we might actually look at where we need to be placing our priorities. But it's fear of the gay folk, fear of the black folk, fear of the Muslim folk, stuff that's easy to get at, that these people who traffic and truck in fear, John, deliberately move the susceptible and the gullible into. Does that work? It's hard to get your head around, you know, we called it global warming. And then the deniers changed it to climate change, so that's what we call it now. I advocate for climate catastrophe. And then the other side that we were just describing, with stuff coming through the earth in spring that shouldn't be coming through the earth, and I don't have nearly the science brain to pull it all together, but I keep looking at it and say, you know, it's not so much climate change as climate shift. If you think of two concentric circles that you can, you know, you can turn one within the other, can you get the image?
Gotcha.
Well, it used to be that the broader circle that was marked winter, spring, summer, fall fell in line with what we expect to be basically the winter solstice, the vernal equinox, the summer solstice and the autumnal equinox. But now that outer ring has been twisted to where where those things no longer correspond to those astronomically derived times. And when you've got your planet out of sync with the astronomy of the universe, John, don't you have a problem?
Well, we have a problem. You know, what doesn't have the problem is nature in general. Because, I mean, you know, when the weather warmed up here, you know, the robins were here. It was a month before they should be here. You know, if we were going by a calendar, they shouldn't come, but they know. You know, the birds know, and the ramps know. You know, it's us that are going to be facing the problem. They can adapt. I don't know.
Oh, over time, they absolutely can. But things that matter to the human species, like growing seasons get wrecked.
Yeah.
Because the mind of humanity is not sharp enough to really get a real big handle on this. I mean, I've seen countless occasions where the really diligent gardeners whom I admire and can never be like, yeah, their perfect little gardens are out in, you know, about this time of year they've got their lettuces and their onions and their broccoli and their cabbages and stuff out, and their potatoes are planted and it's all beautiful. And then another couple of weeks they'll put their tomatoes in the ground, and then we'd get snowed on and everything would die and they'd have to replant everything. Well, they could have put the potatoes and all the kohlrabi kind of derivatives and the onions and stuff and the lettuce, they could have put that in the ground a month ago. And it'd be okay. But you have no way of knowing that weirdness, that weird snow, isn't going to come and wipe you out, and it may yet. You know, all the apples are blossoming now. We may have one more hard frost and goodbye apple crop.
Yeah, and up here where we have to really, the farmers have to really fit into a tight growing season, you know, you can't take a risk like that, and you can't put it off because you get a really narrow window to get your tomatoes and stuff in. People make a lot of money off that up here.
Right, there's great soil, but the growing season is one season. This is not the tropics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's that, and that's the thing. That great line that Albert, who calls in, awesome calls all the time, uses, you know, fear is the mind killer from Dune, I guess.
Right.
I love that, and I try to take that to heart, and I try to, you know, live that way. But, you know, some fear is good, but it's always the stuff that's being pointed away from. And I think here, there's a great tie-in to this issue with this George Zimmerman guy and the Trayvon case, because, I mean, he has been trained to be afraid of this threat. And I have no truck with these people who are trying to paint him as, you know, this is a problem with his mind. He's crazy. You know, he has been trained to be afraid. And I don't think we can cop out with an insanity explanation for this, just like I don't think we can do that with any of these people who go in and shoot up seems like always left wing thing, you know, that gets shot up. And I don't think we can do that. I think that we need to look at trained, cultivated, instilled fear of the other that's coming from the media, it's coming from politicians, it's coming from talk radio, the other side of talk radio, and all that. You know, the what motivates this guy to shoot this young man on some level is everything from listening to Limbaugh and Beck and all those guys, and reading in his paper every day that bullshit journalism shorthand. Sorry about the word.
That's okay.
You know, police describe the suspect as a black male, age 18 to 34, as if that's a description. You know, I mean, it's just there's so many.
Yeah, that's not a description. That's a demographic.
Exactly. There are so many tiny building blocks that are thrown at us from every direction in this culture that is meant to say, be afraid of this person, watch out for this, you never know.
And frankly, you know, the difference, John, between being afraid of having gay kids be openly gay at the prom versus being afraid as, and you know, I try, again, I'm like you, I try to live, fear is the mind killer, fear is the little death. But I am afraid of these goons with guns. Now, granted, the NRA will cite statistics. Millions of people own guns all over America. and they never do nothing bad with them. Yeah, but once in a while, one of them's brain goes sideways, and they do. And the problem is that for normal people like you and me and the Horn family, we don't know who that person is. So, you know, when we see Cephas walking into the Kmart with his peacemaker strapped on, hell, we don't know if he's going for a loaf of bread, some Jack Link's beef jerky to take back to the survival compound, or just going in to shoot the wife because she's in there and he's mad at her and they're having a divorce. Empirically, John, how are we supposed to know what that... What? Shall we just assume that the guy who's armed to the teeth will be safe? The vast body of statistics would suggest that we should. But
yeah,
it's not the rules that are frightening, it's the exceptions.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's a quotable line right there. But I mean, I guess my counter to that, and maybe it's not a great one, is that, you know, I can't. Something in me would die if I looked at everyone as if they were about to cause me harm.
Right.
I mean, and I can't live that way. It's an awful way to go about your life. It's an awful way to think about people. And we are really optimistic about humanity in general, right?
I can't get that poor woman who wouldn't go to the hospital because she was afraid the Obamacare people would get her information and put her on a death panel, and she died 10 days later. I can't get her out of my mind. It's an awful fear is an awful way to live, John. It's also a terminal way to live, because if you fear it, sooner or later you'll find it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know exactly how it is that works, but you know, the woman's mind was poisoned over the course of a decade or more, and then when she needed help, she couldn't get it because her mind wouldn't let her, because her fear owned her mind. And I can't live in fear either. I get Agnes all mad at me sometimes, John. Because I go out in summer when the big thunderstorms roll up, and when they roll up this gorge, it is something to behold. I mean, it's like watching steam boil out of a pot, and the sky turns purple, and the light. And I'll stand out on the porch and watch it come. Bob, you get in here. Get in here, Bob. You're going to get struck by lightning, damn it. And usually I do, just to sort of placate. But maybe, you know, that's the healthy fear that sends Ankh and Gronk into the cave when the thunderstorm comes up, because they saw what happened when Norblap got hit.
Yeah.
But it's not the same thing.
That's a legitimate fear. I think it pays to be respectful of nature. I mean, we know that up here. You know, we're coming off the, you know, 2-century floods in 5 years. I mean, we understand that. But yeah, what if all of this fear could be channeled in some way into fear of things that really are important, like the lightning storm. You know, like the crap we're breathing because of mountaintop removal. Like, what if, you know, what if that could be done? Imagine what a how quickly some of that nonsense would.
Yeah, be. Some of that can be healthy. You know, this is as Brad and Desi noted, this is World Water Day, right?
Yeah.
Well, we have a reason to be afraid of what happens when humanity runs out of fresh drinking water, and we have reason to be afraid of the people who are making us run out of fresh drinking water.
Exactly.
I don't know if you realize it or not, but I ran into it over at Truth Out. The report is out from the Dimmock fracking study, and of course you were the one who introduced us all to Dimmock, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, which report did you see? Go on with your story.
Well, it's the headline merely says, about that Dimmock fracking study, result summaries show methane and hazardous chemicals. This sort of puts the lie to that whole ain't never been no study, what's no never, that actually said that fracking was doing anything to anybody's water.
Well, good, because the first report, the first news report of that was that, oh, the water's fine. There was nothing, there were some things that were slightly elevated, but not out of the ordinary range. This follow-up story that you're looking at, took a look at the methane levels, which were not part of the first report, and said, holy crap, there's tons of methane here, and there's no reason it should be. So the first report on this was, oh, no, it's fine. No, there's nothing wrong there, you know. And someone had to dig a bit and hold the EPA's feet to the fire a little bit.
Right, because the EPA said it was fine based on the fact that there are no established, safe, or permissible limits for that stuff. So they can say everything's fine because they don't have any criteria for saying that it's not.
Right, exactly. If you don't measure or test for something that's bad, then what does it mean when you say it's fine? Exactly.
Yeah. And in fact, it's not, and people are getting poisoned. You know, the access to fresh drinking water. I heard that phrase in the Green News report, John, and that is a freighted phrase for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had once upon a it's still here, but we wouldn't dare drink out of it. We had the deepest water well of anybody in my neighborhood, 72 feet. And it was crystal clear and it was wonderful. Then they blew up the mountains out the road, and it has gotten steadily worse to the point that we wouldn't dare drink it. It's got this slimy red goo that accumulates in the bottom of it and turns everything rust-colored where before it didn't. The coal company, in the name of profit, ruined our access to fresh drinking water. Now, a few years ago, via some federal monies that our politicians got, they ran water lines out here so that we could have what is referred to in these parts as city water, which means that they draw water out of the New River and they run it through a treatment plant and put it through the pipes. And then they turned around and sold it to West Virginia American Water Company. And the bills have done nothing but go up. Not because we're getting better water service or the water is cleaner or more pure or we're using more of it, but because West Virginia American Water is in the profit business, not the water business.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's the standard response when a coal company poisons a community's water. Well, we'll just run you some public water lines. Well, wait a minute. I didn't have a water bill. Now I have a water bill.
That's exactly the story endemic. And what you're saying is they put a damn dollar sign on something that's been watering your family for a couple of generations. And they figured out a way to charge you for it.
Oh, you know, if the volume would have held up, I could have opened up a brewery here based on the water alone.
And it
goes further because my friend Jeff Biggers pointed out to me that there is a new film out now. It's been screened at the Atlanta Film Festival in Georgia. John, it's called Coal Rush.
Oh, okay.
It's by Lorena Luciano and Filippo Piscopo. A pair of Italian filmmakers, and it details the absolute hellish nightmare that the people in Rawl, West Virginia went through when Massey Energy poisoned every last one of their wells. You know, I find it interesting that lady in Arizona don't want nobody teaching about the Quran, because one of the things you'll find if you read the Quran is that poisoning someone's well is an offense unto God.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I would be surprised if there wasn't something similar to that in maybe not in the Old Testament, but in old, Talmudic writings or something. Because, I mean, look at where the people lived that this came from.
Yeah.
That was like stealing somebody's horse in the West. I mean, they're dead. That's it. That's very interesting. And that reminds me, too, of something else that I hear is in the Quran. I haven't read it. A prohibition on lending money at interest.
Yes, and by the way, the Horns Jewish mother, Texas Betsy, is online, John.
Okay.
And she notes.
I didn't step on any toes. I mean.
No. She didn't. You didn't. She says the well poisoning sin is in Torah as well, also destroying fruit trees, which is also in the Quran. You know, there's some things you
absolutely
don't do.
There's some things you don't do to interfere with people's basic sustenance, you know, in the Old Testament. Yeah, it's wells and fruit trees, and here it's water. I mean, that just seems so basic. This is, you know, wisdom of the ages, right? I mean, there's a lot that's worth looking back and thinking about.
Yeah, you know, for every, there's a whole bunch of, you know, stone disobedient children in there, too. But there are basic, you know, if you look at the Ten Commandments that these freaks
Yeah, because the Tennessee legislature, you'll recall, the Tennessee House, I guess it was, just passed a bill saying that the Ten Commandments shall be posted in all public buildings. Well, that's great if people will bother to stop and look at them. Now, three or four of them are religious in nature, about which God you shall worship and stuff. But, you know, John, in our correspondence, I've noted my fascination with Mesoamerican culture. And one of the things that stunned the conquistadors and their priests was that, lo and behold, the priests of those native peoples were reciting rules to live by to the assembled faithful, and they said, don't steal, don't lie about your neighbor, don't kill your neighbor, don't want what your neighbor has. And the priests, wait a minute, he's reciting the Ten Commandments. That must mean that they're the lost tribes of Israel.
Oh, we always come back to the lost tribes of Israel, of course.
Not
that probably wasn't enough to have them declared, what's the phrase, natural Christian men, though.
Right.
Homo, not put to the sword, right.
Right, Homo Christianicus naturaliter.
Right.
Right, and of course it never dawned on these murderous Spaniards that maybe these are the kinds of things that all societies have to have in order to survive.
Yeah.
Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't cheat. No, that was passed.
Don't be a teabagger.
Yeah, don't,
yeah.
Right.
Basically, don't be a teabagger.
Yeah, but the when people, and that's the thing, you know, when people go after those basics, that's something worth being afraid of.
Yeah.
And your fear should motivate you to do something about it. You know, when they come for your water, the water of life, that's like coming for your children. That's a step towards slavery, if not death.
Yeah.
You know, ain't a whole lot, but I've got a little bit of debt slavery that I owe to a water company now, because the profits of West Virginia American Water dictate whether or not my family has the water it needs to survive. Because this house used to have cisterns, John.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rain could be gathered, and they didn't drink it, but they sure washed with it and did their dishes with it and things like that.
Yep.
The well was for drinking and cooking. Well, we can't do that now, because when it rains, the rain is full of God only knows what heavy metals, most among which, of course, are mercury. That's
right,
out.
Which means, in turn, the groundwater is too, so it's got to be treated. I would imagine, Bob, that this West Virginia Water, that's probably a locally owned co-op, right?
With no!
All the profit going back into the community, right?
No!
No? Is it an arm of a foreign conglomerate?
Why, yes, it is.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, see, West Virginia American Water is owned by American Water, and American Water is owned by a holding company in Britain that is a wholly owned subsidiary of a German company that is the single largest polluter in German history.
Wow.
And all the profits go there.
But we shouldn't be afraid of that. We need to be afraid of the guy in the hoodie looking suspicious.
Right.
The pothole.
Or the 2 18-year-old girls holding hands at a prom.
Yeah.
Because that destroys the moral fiber of America.
Well, when I was 18 in high school, that would have disturbed me, too, because I would have hoped to have had a chance with one of them, probably. But I grew up, you know.
Yeah.
I'm kind of past that now, so.
Yeah, it's that whole it's learning to see past self-interest thing.
Yeah, well, that's a big key to it, too. Well, you definitely closed the circle on my point. I appreciate it. I hope that what I said made some sense.
Oh, you make tons of sense. And, you know, you said at the beginning of the call, I hadn't planned to call. Well, John, that's how it works. You don't plan to call. But then, yesterday was Wednesday, today is Thursday, but that's, you know, that's when the Spirit moves upon you, and the next thing you know, you realize you got to get out and witness and testify.
There you go. Excellent. All right, well, listen, you're on fire tonight, sir. I'm enjoying the show, and I'm going to get out of the way and let someone else talk.
John, you have yourself a good evening. It's always good to hear from you.
All right, you too. Hey to the family.
Absolutely. Thanks. Bye now. Dr. John calling from New York State. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
What's up, Jim?
Well, I mean, you were talking about water initially. Well, you were talking about certain other things initially, but I'll start with water. And I was watching television the other day about the things that could threaten the existence of humanity. And one of the first things on the list that these four very learned scientists agreed upon was the absence of potable drinking water.
Yeah, I remember when a scientist from Wheeling Jesuit University said that in another 25 years or so, southern West Virginia will be entirely uninhabitable for the want of water.
Well, you can live without food for X number of days, but you can't live very long without water, that's for sure. That's definitely a very self-sustaining thing.
Absolutely. I mean, look what dehydration did to that guy that made Kony 2012, that video we were talking about from San Diego. Ripped his clothes off and was screaming and banging his hands on the pavement there.
I'm sure. I mean, you know, the absence of water just does terrible things to the human body. You have to have it in order to survive, because we are like, what, 98% water or a high percentage like that?
Yeah, something on that order.
Yeah, I would think so. And I can remember when I helped my father drill a well in the backyard of our home back in 1988, he went down 1,500 feet.
Wow.
And he did it because he was tired of being billed by the water company. And he hooked it up to a irrigation system in the front yard. And I remember, I think it was maybe later on, maybe 89, something like that, when they had a ban on watering your lawn because of a drought. Well, everybody else's lawns were crispy critters, but his was a verdant green. And the police came by there. Why are you watering? This is against the city ordinance.
Because it's my water.
And he said, and he knew the police pretty well because he was mayor of that town for 30 years. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, you can go back here and you can see where this water is coming from. It's my water. And we drill that well. So, you know, basically it was go F yourself.
That's a beautiful moment.
And he had the water tested, the drinking water that came from the city and his water that came from the well, sent it to DHEC. And the guy from DHEC, he knew him over in Columbia, said, sample A, the city water, you drink in recycled piss. He said, your water is pure. Nothing wrong with it. He didn't mess around with people who tried to mess with him. And he knew the importance of, you know, at least trying to be self-sustaining and not to depend on somebody else to tell him what he could drink and what he couldn't. And charge him exorbitant rates for water and tell him when he could not water his flowers and his lawn and stuff like that. I admire him for that. I really do.
Indeed, because going 1,500 feet is no cheap undertaking.
Feet. I mean, he had this machine over there, and it would drill and drill and drill, and then, of course, he had to put the casings in and stuff like that, and he wanted to go 1,500 feet. That was his goal, and he did it. And I helped him do it. And that's within the heat of the summer of 1988 in South Carolina, so you can imagine that wasn't exactly an easy task, but nonetheless, he certainly did it.
Well, since I did apparently conjure you, just tell people your own impression. Tell people what it was like. Tell people what wing nuts sound like in that Beckley Market, Jim.
Oh, Lord. You know, Bob, I don't get out that much, and really, I just don't care to be around all these wing nuts. But when I run into one, I just leave them be, because you know I don't.
But do you remember our buddies that would call in from time to time? I don't want to name any names, but I think Bob Alkincaida really was a real name I was given.
Right.
Baghdad Bob for opposing the war.
Mm-hmm.
The communist was frequently bandied about. And that's, you know, that's what passes for discourse on that side.
Air crap from these people too.
Oh yeah, they openly and freely attacked you.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I would listen to this guy, to whom you know, names without me mentioned, and he was going on about solar panels and how he couldn't climb up on his roof to fix them and this, that, and the other, and how they were not practical. And he had this long discourse that everything, like a hot water heater and all this stuff, was more accessible, and he was trying to make a point against solar power. So just as a joke, I called him up. Now, I don't listen to this fool, but like maybe once a week. And so basically what I said to him, he said, "Who's calling?" And I said, "My name is Zorro." "My blade is sharp. My mind's uncanny. And if you don't stop this bullshit, I'll flip your fanny." His only reply was, "Mercy, mercy, mercy."
Oh, I remember. I remember the morning you called him and flushed the toilet.
Oh yeah, it was just incredible. Listen, on a lighter note, you were talking about exchanges with McDonald's, and we'll get off your subject here about some things just for a humorous thing. When I was in Amsterdam years ago, I went into one of these sex shops where you could buy Astro joints and all this kind of stuff, and I had this dollar bill that I picked up there, and it was just like a dollar bill. And so, but instead of George Washington in the center, there was a lurid sex scene.
Nice.
And so I put the bill in the back of my wallet. And so when I came back home, I think it was a McDonald's or a Roy Rogers outside of Andrews on Camp Springs Road. Yeah, that's where it was. And I inadvertently passed that thing.
Oh, dear.
So I heard the lady behind the counter say, "Get his attention, please." And this guy tapped me on the shoulder and said, "This lady wants to talk to you." And I said, "Ma'am, what's wrong?" She said, sir, I do not believe this is legal tender." And I just went, "Whoops."
Yeah, I don't think it is either.
I mean, whoops is when you gargle with Drano.
Whoops
when you... Well, I won't go into any other whoops to make a mistake, but I mean, I certainly put that thing in back. But I was home later for Christmas, so I put it in my sister's handbag in her wallet.
You're brutal.
Well, just
did you ever, did you get the "Oh my God, Jim, what have you done?" phone call?
No. I would never ask about that because, I mean, asking about it would be admitting to it.
No. You don't ask about it. It's when you get the call. Do you know what I found in my purse?
Well, I sort of heard that to a third person. And it was my mom that told me that Penny had some problems at the store. And I said, "Well, what kind of problems?" And she said, "I don't know where she picked it up, but it was an obscene bill." I said, "Oh, my dear, where in the world could she have gotten that?" And, boy, I didn't say anything more about that.
No, you just privately relished that moment.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it was just a matter of one of my Roseanne moments, basically. And so, yeah, I know what it's like to...
Well, see, that's right up there with Tim from L.A.'s query about do y'all accept Hawaiian money?
Well, I gave you one more story. It happened in the same place. And when I went into the store, they were supersizing fries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there was a foreign lady who was behind the counter, and she was real nice. And it was like lunch and stuff like that. This place is on Camp Spring Road, right outside of Andrews Air Force Base. Anyway, so I thought she said, "May I circumcise you?" I said, "I'm already circumcised." And everybody in there just started laughing like hell, and I could have left by opening the door, but just by going through the crack in the bottom. But I thought that's what she said. So I go back to my installation on the base, and I tell that story, and honest to God, you talk about the horse laughs I got on me. And I told my boss, I said, well, if you can't laugh at yourself, you can't laugh at anybody else, can you?
That's the truth.
So, I mean, you know, I've had two experiences like that, but I mean, I know they don't relate too much to what you were going on about with the problems of the world, but nonetheless.
Well, I am the smoothie whisperer, so, yeah.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Or maybe it's the smoothies of Madison County. I mean, that had a Bob Kincaid in it, too, didn't it?
I guess it did, absolutely. But, I mean, these poor people who work for these chain restaurants like that.
Well, it's a brutal existence, Jim. It's heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah, they're treated like serfs. And you have these district managers who come down there, and I don't know how McDonald's does it, but I know you have these franchises that are sold to these private individuals. I think that's how they work it. And these people can be pretty hard taskmasters, and they're paying these poor people just a pittance of a wage to work under appalling conditions. You imagine the heat back in that kitchen with all the grills and stuff going, and they have to come to the front counter and present a happy face and, like, you know, to make you want to buy something because they're so pleasant. I mean, like you, I couldn't handle working in the place.
Not for an hour.
Not at all. And you can imagine some of the customers who come in there, and they're in a bad mood, and all they want to do is take out their bad mood and somebody
else. Well, that's where my mind went, Jim. This idea that the woman had fear in her eyes when she apologized to me for, and you know, I'm not a mean guy, so I can just imagine what kind of, what do you mean you're out? All right, give me the, I don't want one of them. What the hell's a mango? Just give me the wild berry, dang it.
Well,
you want to see human beings behaving badly? Go to McDonald's at noon. Go to McDonald's right at the height of breakfast. Breakfast is worse because that's when they're crankiest.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they are.
It's all there on display. So,
unfortunately, these people have to work in these conditions. They have to work under for no money at all, practically.
Right, and see, the problem is that there is a segment of our society, generally referred to these days as the 1%, who have transformed American culture from what was supposed to be a classless society into one where the class, though not overtly stated, is implied brutally, Jim.
Well, I think it was supposed to be basically an egalitarian society, but it's become so stratified.
Right.
It's just.
As recently as when I was a teenager, you know, McDonald's was not a place that you made a career. It was staffed by kids from 16 to 20.
That's it. You know, who were trying to pick up a few extra bucks to buy whatever they needed, a CD or, you know, or a record or maybe augment their wardrobe or to take somebody out on a date, whether it was, you know, a straight date or a gay date or whatever. But, I mean, that's basically what these people did. And to give them some experience in the workforce and how to work under certain conditions and follow instructions and follow orders. So, to a certain extent, but I mean, you see people who are in their 60s working in these places.
Well, that's what this little lady was who was waiting on me. She had to be 65 if she was a day.
And she was probably scared to death.
And that just breaks my heart, Jim. Breaks my heart.
Oh, I know. And somebody's going to come in there and terminate her employment, and that would be the end of her career. Like these greeters at Walmart, you know, that's another thing. I mean, God, that's one reason I will not go in that store. I haven't been in a Walmart in over 15 years, and I'm not going to go in one.
Well, good for you. More people did that, I think we'd be in a better place, Jim.
Well, I'm thankful that I can do it. And I'll tell you one more story that happened to me. I've had a staph infection recently, and I had to go in the hospital for it. And I got out and talked to the doctor, and he said, well, I want to give you this medication called Vioxx or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shame on me. I didn't realize this medication was contraindicated with other medications I'm taking, all right? I mean, hell, 30 years ago, I was doing some drugs, now I'm on medication. That's a hell of a bridge.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know what that prescription costs?
I could scarcely guess.
$3,500 for a two-week supply.
Jesus criminy!
Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, I have good insurance, and the insurance paid everything but $500. And then when I get home, I realize I can't take it. And I had asked the guy, the physician, what about Bactrin? I said, that's a pretty efficacious antibiotic. It's broad spectrum, and it kills just about everything. I said, hell, they used to treat AIDS patients with it with pneumocystis back in the 80s when the disease first surfaced. Well, I want you to try this. I mean, you know, and I've got a bottle of pills over here that I can't take.
And you can't take back.
Can't take back. And I used to work in medical operations for the government when I worked for the Army. And I know a little bit about this stuff. I mean, a little bit to know when I'm being hosed. But nonetheless, it was kind of a rough situation. And I can just feel for people who don't have insurance and stuff like that. Because, I mean, $3,500 for like 20, well, what's 2 weeks? 28 pills? Or two times 14, you know, twice a day, 28 pills, $3,500 from Pfizer.
Yeah, well, and I can't begin to touch that, Jim, but, you know, there are realities out there, and the realities that I hear about from members of the Horn family, and that I'm beginning to experience for myself. Like I said, I can't touch $3,500, but frankly, you know, when I found out that I had elevated blood glucose, and they said, get a handle on it now, so that way you won't have to stick needles in yourself. And I said, okay. And lo and behold, the friendly folks at Bayer, I think it was, or had given a bunch of glucose monitor gizmos, and so they handed me one and said, you know, go and be well. And so I started testing my blood sugar, but it came with like 10 test strips, which is 5 days worth of testing.
Right.
Well, I went to get me a new bottle of test strips. You know, mm-hmm. A month's worth.
How much did that set you back?
$100.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I'll tell you, if your glucometer says between 90 and 120, you're doing pretty well.
Well, and that's where it lives. My problem is that I guess it's almost like that climate change versus the seasons versus the calendar that John and I were talking about. I have always been, from the time I was little tiny, hypoglycemic. You know, where you get the sweats and the beads of sweat come out and you start to shake and jitter and feel like you're just coming apart.
Oh, that's unpleasant. Very unpleasant.
It's nasty. And then, you know, in order to make it go away, you eat 6 Reese's Cups, and then you just go to sleep.
That's it.
Well, what apparently happened is my body got... I happened to be having one of those episodes, and I tested my blood sugar. And I was expecting it to be like 60. It was 85.
85.
You know, my body is so used to having elevated blood glucose that when it drops into normal, I start feeling like I'm running down. So now with the benefit of this, lucky for me, it's generic and it's plant-derived and it's been around since 1928. And so I can get it on the $5 formulary somewhere.
That like metformin?
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, metformin is a good drug.
Yeah, it is. It came with a headache for the first couple of weeks, but that went away.
Now, they had another drug out called Actos for diabetics.
Yeah, that'll kill people.
Exactly. And, you know, every day on television, it was five times a day from, you know, and that's made by Takeda Corporation from Japan. And they had these warnings about it causing bladder cancer and stuff like that. And so, I mean, I just wonder where is the responsibility these people have. And, you know, they're having all kinds of lawsuits for it. But metformin is a safe thing for that.
Yeah, and that's what I've seen. I've been religiously monitoring since I started. And generally, the worst I've seen is running up to 140. But that was after some very, very bad behavior.
Oh, yeah.
We all do it.
We do.
But mostly, you know, I'll get up in the morning and I'll see 89, 92, 94. And then I test it before bed, and it's generally because I do my misbehaving later in the day. It'll be, you know, I might see a 124 or something like that. But it's staying under control. But it's by the same token, Jim, it's terrifying.
Well, yeah, when you have to get up, and the first thing you do is have to draw blood from your finger or wherever you draw it from, and then you have to wait for the meter to engage and give you your reading. It's not the way you want to begin your day.
No, I've always been pain averse. I guess I never could have made it in the S&M scene.
Well,
either on the inflicting or the receiving end. It's no.
Absolutely. And then you have to log it in the little book they give you and all this stuff. I've been there, done that. So understand and. But anyway, I just wanted to share those vignettes with you.
And I'm glad you did.
Well, we've gone the whole gamut here from potable water to
lurid dollar bills
to excessive drug prices, and then, you know, having.
Oh, and by the way, before you do go, I have to pass this along to you because it seems a decent thing. Our good friend Cindy out in the Great Northwest.
Yeah.
She said, call your local free clinic and donate that bottle of meds to a registered nurse or a doctor for the clinic quietly. And they'll accept them. But she also said this, did Jim describe Vioxx? Good thing he can't take it. I used it a few times and had to have my jaw operated on.
That's some nasty stuff, Bob. I'm going to tell you one thing right now. The contraindications listed on it. And I asked this asshole doctor, and I'm not going to name any names, but I said, let's use Bactrin. And of course, I had to get a Bactrin prescription filled, and the cost to me was $1.34.
But see, 2 days before you saw the doctor, a representative from Giant Pharmaceutical Corporation of America had been in there and said, you know, doc, If you just get 500 people on this, we'll give you a free trip to the Virgin Islands.
Yeah, that's the way they work.
They do that. They really, really do that. It's illegal as hell, but that doesn't slow them down much.
Oh no! And don't ever get in there when you're wanting to see a doctor or the nurse practitioner, or anybody like that, particularly the doctor, when one of those drug representatives comes in.
Oh, it's
because they're going to be in there with him for an hour, and it's going to throw your. I mean, when they come in, the schedule for seeing patients
goes straight to hell.
Yeah, goes straight to hell out the window. They don't care at all. But I mean, you can tell Cindy. I said thank you very much, and I'm glad that I only took it for like 2 days. And I just called him. I said I cannot take this shit. I said this is causing me. The last 2 nights were just absolute pure hell. And $3,500.
Well, they tried to change my cholesterol meds too, to something called Vitorin. And at the risk of us sounding like a couple of cranky old people sitting around discussing our ailments,
well, these things happen to
people. Need to know this stuff. This Vitorin, I did a little research on it. Not a, and what it is it's a combination of simvastatin and some other drug. And simvastatin works. It just doesn't work for me because it makes my liver light up like W.C. Fields' nose.
I see.
But in combination, it was supposed to be in combination with this other drug that it would prevent heart attacks and bad breath and yada yada yada, all that stuff. And it turns out that the company itself did a study on it and found out that not only did it not do any of the things they claimed it did, it also made things worse.
Oh, yeah.
And they put it out anyway, and they've got my little clinic down the road handing out samples saying, start on this. And it made me feel like crap.
Well, that's what they were doing with Actos 10 years ago. They were giving out these big bottles, these big boxes of it, like they looked like became the size of a carton of cigarettes and this, that, and the other. And but nonetheless, I don't know how these people get away with it because their actions, these drug companies, and what they do to people. We're, you know, basically to them, we are cheaper than chimpanzees.
Well, it ain't exactly funny, but I think that's the toaster of the night.
Well,
cheaper than chimps.
That's exactly right. I mean, I remember this book by Jessica Mitford called Cruel and Unusual Punishment. And she was her sister was Unity Mitford, who fell in love with Hitler, and when they declared war between...
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
She shot herself in the English garden in Munich, but nonetheless... Unity was a fascist and Jessica was a socialist, and
right.
And she wrote about how the drug companies would use prison populations to test drugs on. And in exchange of the prison economy, they would get cigarettes and chewing gum and stuff like that. And one of the drugs that they were testing was called Prolixin, which caused deterioration of the femoral nerve sheath and just unbearable pain. And, you know, if you can read that book by Jessica Mitford, Cruel and Unusual Punishment, it will absolutely blow your mind. I have a copy of it here. I haven't read it in a long time. But there's one chapter that deals with the drug company. It's called Cheaper Than Chimpanzees. That's where I got that from. Well, buddy, listen.
It needs to be brought back into the common parlance, Jim. Have yourself a wonderful evening.
You too.
Bye now.
Out here.
That's our neighbor, old buddy Jim. Randy asking, didn't Zoloft come off patent? I don't know if it was. I just saw a notice in the local pharmacy that, Lexapro is coming off patent. Yay! So there will be a $5 version of serotonin, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And of course, people will stop prescribing that because there will be a new, you know, $500 a month version that comes along. A couple of lines open if you want to jump in on the conversation. It's about 7 minutes past the third hour of the program. 7 minutes past eight here on the East Coast. This is the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. You know how to reach the program if you don't feel like calling. That number or that email, of course, is Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid @gmail.com. That also happens to be the means by which you presently have to use if you wish to contribute to the Thrifty 250 or any amount that you choose to keep the horn on the, help keep the horn going, help keep it on the air. With me being gone a significant chunk of last week and or next week and not being able to use the time that I'm sitting there doing the radio row, it's kind of embarrassing to do pitches there. But if you want to contribute, that's how you do it. You log into your PayPal account, and then using the send money function, just use that email address, bobkincaid@gmail.com, because that's what's tied to the PayPal button, which, as a result of all the hacking that took place on the Horn's website, is presently still not present. That nice language, Bob, is presently not available on the headonradionetwork.com website because John is slowly adding things back. What happened is the hackers got so mad at us long about Super Tuesday that they erased the entire website. No kidding. And so everything had to be pulled out, and it's being put back one piece at a time. And one of the pieces that isn't back yet is the PayPal button. So if you just go to PayPal, log into your PayPal account, and bobkincaid@gmail.com is the PayPal address. Let's keep things going. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Oh, you'll have that. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston.
I just sent an email to you, a Facebook message to your Facebook page. It was a link I just caught a few moments ago, and to be honest, I'm still kind of, you know, it was moving, disturbing, frightening, angering, kind of related to what John in the Finger Lakes region was saying about fear and whether it's being misdirected and that sort of thing. And it's certainly being misdirected, and I think it can be a useful emotion, and the anger as well. But as John was suggesting, maybe we can channel that to something constructive. And so my response was to pass that video link along, and it was something by a man named Garth Lenz, who spoke at a TED conference in Victoria, British Columbia, about what he called the largest and most devastating industrial project taking place on Earth right now. And, you know, there are so many going on, but this one's in the boreal forest of Canada, and it's that tar sands project. And it was interesting that this came to my attention, you know, today of all days, when a lot of us saw that image of Obama in Oklahoma around the pipes. And and I've noticed recently over the past few days, Rush Limbaugh has been doing, really focusing on oil and the oil industry spin, and there is no alternative. And so anyway, if you have a chance to check it out.
Oh, I will.
Yeah. You'll be utterly outraged, and you'll be very familiar with a lot of it. And he's a photographer as well. I'm not sure about Garth Lenz, what his background is, but I think he's a photographer as well. And you know, so much to take away from what this guy was saying, but a couple of things. He was talking about the struggle of the indigenous people there, and, you know, their cancer rates have spiked since development, maldevelopment has begun. They've created a toxic waste lake, something like half the size of Manhattan, with many more on the way.
And you know, that's one of the hallmarks of this mega industrial pursuit of increasingly finite hydrocarbon resources, Preston.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioning that lake reminds me, and I do not wish to discount the horror you just described in any way. I'm trying to manifest a sense of kinship. The Brushy Fork impoundment down in western Raleigh County, West Virginia. Most people, and I've mentioned this before, most people think the largest dam in the Western Hemisphere is Hoover Dam out by Las Vegas. It isn't. It is the Brushy Fork Dam, which is comprised of dirt and cast-offs from the mining process and shale, compacted in the hopes that it will hold back 9 billion gallons of toxic waste.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hope. It's in the hope of. It is not in the knowledge that it will.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you described with cancer, with heart disease, among the indigenous peoples up there, is stalking the narrow valleys and hollers of southern West Virginia as well. And that's part of this, Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign that we have undertaken, the AKE campaign, that we're trying to build some strength behind, build some impetus behind. That has been, and that's what has been taking me to D.C. so frequently of late. Because this is the kind of thing where you have choice. And I had any from the filmmaker of whom you speak, nor would I get any disagreement from the indigenous peoples in Canada. Silence is worse than sin. It is a manifestation of complicity.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to holler this for all we're worth.
I agree. And, you know, we can holler a little bit louder as we do network with others who are waging similar struggles and like you said, developing kinship instead of, you know, the competitive stuff that we got in a habit of. So, yeah, and it's getting louder. I think the madness of this stuff and just the anti-life dynamic of it is just getting more and more clear. So, hence the increased PR campaigns.
Oh, yeah, and I was going to mention that, Preston. I'm glad you came back around to it. When you catch people like the oxymoron really hammering a topic day after day after day,
mm-hmm.
you may rest assured that that's not happening, what's the word, organically?
That hasn't just
captured his fancy.
Yeah, yep.
Word has gone out.
Yep.
And consequently, he is operating within the framework of the messaging that comes that is driven by the upper echelons of that toxic cabal, if you will. You know, isn't it interesting that the pro-life crowd is the crowd that supports the most toxic policies that are damaging to the broadest number of innocents?
Yep. And they co-opted the pro-life banner because they, you know, they don't want people to realize, you know, just how upside down they've turned the reality, and they're anti-life. In fact, in some moments they're
pro
cop to it. They're pro destruction of the world.
They're pro death.
You know, in their vision, you know, the rapture will come and da da da. You don't worry about the future. Ayn Rand, you know, they found some Ayn Randian philosophy about the virtues of selfishness. You don't think about future generations. You don't think about indigenous culture.
And it's not a philosophy. Huh. It's not a philosophy, Preston. It's an ex post facto justification.
Yeah.
I am this way. I have found this thing. This thing justifies how I am, so it's okay to go on being the way I am.
Yeah.
I mean, this quote that I mentioned earlier from Barry Goldwater, you know, right-wing freak that he was, is chilling. Because if Barry Goldwater was saying that the Christian right was going to be toxic to America, and bear in mind, this is the guy who said he was willing to use nuclear devices on other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Really, how wicked, how lunatic, how evil are these so-called Christians?
Yeah, and just the energy of this industry, how wicked can it be? It got so bad that someone like Paul Weyrich, late in his life, became kind of a guy I admired. You know, we know him as the person who, you know, Tom Hartman plays that notorious quote of his about how we've got to keep the voting participation low, because the right wing can leverage some advantage if they keep it low and get their people active and to the polls. You know, it's like a recognition of how they are elitist policies, and they have to just get their segment
And that plays into that that Atlantic article that Dr. John sent me that pointed out that a lot of Willard Romney's support is coming from during a low interest primary season, and he is being bolstered by members of his church.
Okay.
Low turnouts favor the candidate who can gin up the most voters among narrow constituencies.
Yeah. But back to Weyrich really quickly, and a whole raft of other stuff that I really dislike about the guy. And yes, bring that out. But towards the end of his life, he became an advocate of all things mass transit. And I'm not sure what sparked this exactly, but years ago, I actually videotaped him giving a talk here in Denver to a mass transit advocacy group. And it was really well informed and well done. And interestingly, at one point, he said something like how popular he used to be in kind of Republican circles. But once he got on this topic, he kind of stopped getting invitations to the radio shows and stuff. So...
Yeah, he got drummed out of the club.
Yeah, because he did follow a particular industry fundamentalism.
Right, you don't get to, and that's the whole thing about mentioning pro-life people. See, the pro-life people consider themselves a narrow constituency who are concerned with the rights of the unborn. But if you question them and you ask them, well, what about health care for the living? That's socialism. Well, what about green energy? It'll never be a reality. We got to drill, baby, drill. They are signed on with every element of the right-wing agenda, and you must, as Paul Weyrich found out, as you've noted, Preston, you cannot be a cafeteria conservative. You must sign off on the entire doctrine and dogma, or none at all. What was his name from... That was who wrote the Axel of Evil speech. He dared to come out and criticize Republicans, and he got drummed out. He lost his job at the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, David Frum. Frum actually appears in that film about Noam Chomsky called Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky in the Media.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a classic of documentaries, came out in around 1990. But David Frum had an exchange with Chomsky about foreign policy disagreement that was interesting. And so, yeah, there again, there's a guy, Frum, who I really did not like in a lot of ways, what his attitude was. But, a few of his recent pieces have been more, thoughtful, I guess, retrospect. Even of all people... Roger Ailes, I had a kind thought towards that guy, Jabba the Hutt himself. I noticed, that wonderful David Brock book just came out about the Fox propaganda machine, how
right.
It works, how it's like they're so manipulative and deceitful. It's like, gosh, you must hate your own kind. And, more recently, Rachel Maddow just published a book called Drift about our kind of the insanity of our militarism, and Roger Ailes actually gave it a positive blurb. Now, I haven't read the book yet, but the feeling I get from it is that it's really good and important. I heard her talking about it coming out, I think just last night or a couple nights ago, and she talks about things like these real-life Dr. Strangelove moments we've had, like accidentally dropping nuclear bombs on tomato fields in Spain. They didn't detonate, but, I don't know the details of it, but it created problems, soil contamination and stuff. And other times that we've almost, again, in our concept of progress and civilization and security, we've almost nuked the world a few times. So anyway, Roger Ailes recognized the worth of Rachel's book, and I thought, I still got a little bit of hope, Bob. Is that...
You got it. Look, every now and then you got to nurture that little seed, because it's easy for it to dry up, Preston.
It is, man, definitely. And towards the end of that earlier video I mentioned to you, the Garth Lenz thing that I posted to your Facebook page, right at the end, he says, I mean, really, it's a horror story listening to him at points. And on top of the indigenous people being harmed, we're going to be harmed, obviously, but they are also taking out the bus in. And again, like, still, Western Live is still going, pulling the bite. But at the end, we can stop this. And he talks about the massive network that's developing, and the successes it's had, and it's just growing. And so, let's all put our shoulders behind it wherever we can, whenever we can. And, also a heads up around the nuclear power industry.
Oh no.
Yeah. And a lot of people, they've been doing some really good, PR for themselves and kind of selling themselves as the new clean green. And they make the argument that, they don't put out a lot of CO2. And right now they don't. They put out about a third when you factor in the mining and the milling and transporting and
right. Everything
else. It's going to get much higher as the grades of ore, uranium ore, get not so good. But they're skipping the other parts about the radiation and the mining that the Navajo did of uranium and the lung cancers that caused and the waste issue and the regular leaks of, water and steam. And it's a mess in a lot of ways, but their big PR firm, they've got a lot of PR people working for them, Burstyn, Marsteller from...
They're huge.
Yeah. And they also have something called the Nuclear Energy Institute. And they're actually taking out, and they spend tens of millions of dollars a year. They're taking out ads that are going to be appearing on The Daily Show, apparently, Jon Stewart. And George Monbiot, his work?
Yes.
With The Guardian. I like a lot of what he does, but he did this hit piece on Helen Caldicott recently. And both the content and the tone of his argument was like right out of the playbook of, the right-wing science manipulators.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a mess, but...
Well, let me since we've touched on it a little bit, let me run something past you real quick, Preston, because I'd like your thoughts. You connect dots real well. By the way, I'm looking at the Garth Lenz slideshow right now. It's Jesus.
In one moment it's the most beautiful, the most beautiful photos you've seen, and then in the next it's again it's Mordor.
It is. And
so little awareness.
And in a way, for being flat. It carries all the horror that comes with mountaintop removal. It's like mountaintop removal upside down.
Yeah. And today, we got to the point where, well, maybe we won't go over the sand hills in Nebraska. We'll skip the Ogallala Aquifer. That would be our big compromise. That's the whole political establishment. That's saying, okay, we'll do that.
Well, was it Albert last night who was saying, okay, build the pipeline, stop it in Chicago, refine the gas there, and make sure it's sold only in the United States?
Yeah.
And that leads me to the question I was going to ask you. I was driving along, and I was listening to NPR the other day, and I heard this story about the praises that had been heaped on Japan and other nations, and the recommendation of the Department of State and Secretary Clinton that no action be taken against these other nations because they're still doing, I guess, some business with Iran, but not as much business with Iran. And Japan was singled out for mention in the story. And it was all about how, even in the wake of the Fukushima disaster and the profound difficulties that had put Japan in as far as their energy needs are concerned, blah, 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 blah. Nothing about the poison, nothing about the dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's energy, energy, energy. But the mention was made that, Japan was deserving of praise for reducing its Iranian oil imports despite such brutal circumstances. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason or other, my mind cast over to the tar sands. And everybody who's paying attention knows that the tar, that any gasoline derived from the Alberta tar, or from the tar sands generally, is destined for Asia.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Consequently, the Iranian boycott comes as a double bonus for the oil industry. Iranian oil into the market is reduced, which creates demand for this filth being poured out of these Mordor-like hell pits in Canada.
Yeah.
And you'll forgive me, Preston, if I say that it all just made a little too much sense.
You know, it makes a lot of sense if the highest principle is maximize profit. And
right. And no matter how many corpses you do it on.
Yeah. Short-term profit, of course, they're going to plow through it quickly enough, but same with stock, fish populations. I read this quote from some fish tycoon exec and talking about how we got to just go through it as quickly as possible because it's running out. So it's like, again, madness, but short-term profit makes sense there. And this constant blocking, the nuke industry says, oh, we just want to stop climate change. Yet at the same time, this is the same industry that's constantly, blocking, undercutting, subverting efforts to develop solar and wind and, conservation and efficiency measures. They've got think tank people going after people like Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute, who's saying nuke is not the answer. To the extent that it's on the table, it's going to knock wind and solar off the table. It's going to be a massive diversion of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. The scientific geniuses that we could be developing for solar are instead going to do another, the latest and greatest. They've always got some new version. But time and again, overruns and leaks and and the uranium issue, and the mining stuff, and the waste issues, it goes on and on and on. And it's so anti-democratic, state after state. People are saying they don't want it, but they are. Harvey Wasserman called the nuclear power industry, it's become like a autonomous state, and it just gets to impose itself on the actual states of the country. And another place where there's a huge battle going on, very rarely spoken about in the major media, but heroic efforts and both Harvey Wasserman and Helen Caldicott have their own kind of internet radio programs. Once a week they'll interview a whole range of scholars and activists and just really informative stuff, crucially important grassroots media work going on out there. So I remember you mentioning how you don't want to be the only internet radio person, and I'm telling you, Bob, you are not alone. They're up at dandelions. It's a good story from nature. We've been warring on dandelions for all these
years. I've been watching for the dandelions to come up because I'm going to go get me some.
Yeah, they keep popping out. They keep showing up. It's a beautiful thing. And
they're delicious.
And they're so healthy. It's like spinach,
Well, again, it's one of those things that mountain people and others have known for years. Dandelion greens are a central component of the Mediterranean diet, especially which is eaten on Crete. And people on Crete live to incredibly long years.
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily daughtery years.
Right. Great.
Each greens. And I honest to God, I keep dropping these really, really broad hints to Agnes. And at the risk of this sounding kind of sexist, I'll say things like, You know, I'd eat greens every day if they were available to me. Because I would. And I could probably be weaned off that modicum of bacon fat that I generate, you know, some sort of god-awful animal fat that I require them to be cooked in.
Yeah.
You know, the canola oil could serve the... Hey, you know, you don't even necessarily have to have any fat at all. You get them all cooked up, seasoned right. You get them in the bowl. I still have this bottle here beside me. I keep it in the studio because this is where I often eat my evening meal. It's a bottle of little hot peppers and garlic that just had boiling hot white vinegar poured over it. And when the vinegar starts to run low, you heat up some more vinegar and you pour it back on, and it stays hot and spicy. And to put that, David in Tennessee sent that along to me, and they're almost like heirloom peppers now, I guess, because they've been rejuvenated so many times. We may have to build a religion around them.
Great.
But to put those on a bowl of greens, and I will go out and gather dandelions when they start coming up.
Excellent. That sounds good.
Because they're yummy, and I don't know. Do they grow out there in Colorado where you are, Preston? Sometime in life, you deserve not the dandelions, but the ramps. Sometime in life, you deserve to treat yourself to some ramps. You will be a changed man.
I heard you talking about those when you were speaking with Bob or John in Finger Lakes.
We wax rhapsodic about them. I got an email a little bit ago from Ron in Raleigh saying, "You are cordially invited to the Robbinsville Ramp Festival. The festivities will be April 25th and 26th. Bring your own breath mints, BYOB.
Nice.
And that's down in North Carolina. So they grow all up and down the Appalachian chain, and they'll cure what ails you and keep people away from you until what ails you is gone. There was a very there was a newspaper that was printed here in West Virginia for a lot of years called the West Virginia Hillbilly, and offhand I can't remember the publisher's name. He was a legend and an institution in this state. He mailed its paper worldwide. It was brilliant, and once upon a time, just to give his and it often went to expatriate Appalachian people living out in the flatlands. And one spring issue, he poured a little teeny tiny beaker of ramp juice in his printer's ink before the run. And he got a letter from the Postmaster General of the United States. Jim Comstock was his name. He got a letter from the Postmaster General of the United States telling him that if he ever did that again, his mailing privileges would be revoked summarily, because the postmaster, and I mean, it was signed, you know, you knew the postmaster really signed. There was none of that PM:// you know. No, yeah. He signed it with his little pen. If you ever do that again, we will revoke your postal privileges, because apparently the presence of one issue of that paper in a humongous bag of mail was enough to foul the entire thing.
Wow, that's interesting. The pungency of some of the stuff out there in the world. I noticed kind of on the other end of the pungent scale, the first blossoms of the crab apple trees here in Denver have come out again, definitely early by a couple weeks, but still very pleasant nevertheless, and very nice smell. Crab apples, I don't know, you can't really forage. Well, I don't know what you can do with those. I think the squirrels like them, at least.
No, people do too.
Okay, I'm just so...
Crab apple jelly.
Okay.
And the other thing you can do is, if you like, for instance, a dry wine, You can run them through a cider press and get a dry hard cider so dry it'll create dust in your mouth.
I've recently come upon hard apple cider, and I found an organic one, actually. I think it's out of Wisconsin. But apparently, I was watching that Botany of Desire, the Michael Pollan.
Oh, I've never seen the film. I love the book.
Okay, well, PBS did like an hour-long presentation of it, focusing on apples, tulips, marijuana,
and potatoes.
Potatoes, yeah. And the apple segment mentioned how hard the alcoholic apple cider was very popular at one point.
Oh, well, John Chapman, also known as Johnny Appleseed, left and came down the Ohio River with all of his little seedlings and stuff. And not a single, and some of those trees, at least their progeny still exists out through Ohio and Indiana. He got off the boat at Marietta, Ohio, which was quite the bustling little frontier enclave at the time, and went about his business of being Johnny Appleseed. There's not a single one of the trees that he planted, Preston, that yields an apple that would be fit to pluck off the tree and eat. They're vile. They are absolutely so sour as to turn your mouth inside out. You can't make a pie with them. You can't fry them and put them on biscuits. You can't sugar them to get them sweet. They're just hateful. The only thing they're good for, Preston, is putting in the press, and not apple juice, but apple cider, because the frontier, and it's another one of those things that people don't, especially, you know, the fundamentalists and stuff, don't like to know about. America spent its first 100 years drunk off its ass. I mean,
still a little tipsy, I think.
Yet that's the golden age that they yearn for. And I said, well, you know, crack the lid. Now, you live in civilization. David in Tennessee will correct me if I get it wrong, but there is a particularly amazing cider that comes out of Great Britain. Great Britain is the home of the greatest ciders. And it's like Pink K, and it comes in an opaque glass black bottle with a pink K on it. And I had one bottle, and it is life-affirming, world-changing, just wonderful.
Great.
So maybe keep an eye out for it. Be very careful, though, as you look on your cider bottles, to make sure that you're not buying cider that is coming from the vineyards of Ernesto y Julio Gallo, because it's going to be all chemicaled up. And
yeah.
The Woodchuck brand of the American ciders, Vermont cider, last I checked, was pretty reliable. I ran into some English ciders when I was in East Tennessee last fall that came in a can that were really wonderful, and they had a sweet and a sweet hard cider and a dry hard cider, and they had a pear cider that just wow.
Oh, interesting. I will keep an eye out for sure.
And I'm tickled to be able to tell you that. New Belgium Brewery. Are those the boys out there in Colorado?
Yep.
Their stuff has crossed the Mississippi River and is more and more available around here.
That's cool. My dad was mentioning that they're thinking about opening a brewery maybe in Asheville, North Carolina. That's where my dad lives. And so they're expanding. And see, that, you know, there's a business really to root for, and I hope it becomes a bigger business.
I love to see things like breweries come into communities, because breweries will get really proactive about their water.
They've been huge on helping preserve the Poudre River in northern Colorado. There was some big, massive hydro project planned for it. It was one of the last, free-flowing rivers in the area. They also are battling, the water, pollution issues, and they're definitely there. And they're also a model of how we could have this less destructive kind of industrial revolution of sorts. They have wind power, they've got solar power, they use the leftover hops as a biomass. Biomass is getting portrayed in negative ways mostly, and there are certainly aspects of it that are hugely problematic if you're using foodstuffs and things, corn. But if you're using leftover hops and you're getting energy from that, more power to you, so to say.
Yeah.
So to speak. And they also help organize a yearly sustainable fair They've been doing it for like 8 years now. They provide all of their employees, and New Belgium's also worker-owned, and they provide their employees, I think, at a year anniversary, they get a free bicycle. And, you know, and people still have cars. People still, you know, we're still in these systems, and it's not about guilt-tripping ourselves or condemning other people. It's about changing systems that we find ourselves in and having choices, you know, other options.
And see, those things that you described, Preston, are the things that, if we are to have a future here in Appalachia, have to start happening here. We need the fat tires of the world happening here. You know, there's a little bitty brewery, a little fledgling brewery cranking out kegs for the local restaurant over across the river outside Fayetteville. And, you know, I root for them.
Yeah.
I can't drink beer like I used to like to drink beer, but I would gladly drink their beer if I could. It's that whole blood sugar thing Jim and I were talking about. But we've got to break the cycle of this hateful, carbon-driven 19th, 18th century monoculture, 19th century really, 19th century monoculture that obtains here. That's where the hope's going to lie. You know, it doesn't all have to be. I mean, it'd be nice to have some solar panel factories and some wind turbine factories. It doesn't have to all be that, though. It can be neat little things like ecologically conscious breweries that it would be. I mean, you know what? I'm 49 years old. I would crawl across ground glass to work for those people. Even at my advanced age, I'd love to spend 10 years of my career working to advance what they do.
Me too, definitely. You know, that would be good work. And there's a lot of good work to be done. There's no sense in all these, you know, people who want jobs. We should be able to make them happen. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the kind of independent field of independent business. There's a business alliance for local livable economies. That's like 20,000 businesses are now members of this, and it's sustainability stuff, it's arts and crafts stuff, it's make your own music.
You know, Charleston, West Virginia, in the middle of the dark, bloody, beating heart of the coal industry, Charleston's getting ready to have its Green Festival.
Excellent.
And you know, you can't help but just walk away with a little bit of hope that sure, it's only 2 or 3 days.
Uh-huh.
But people will walk through it, and they will and they will have these little Satori moments, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. And
by the way, David in Tennessee telling me that in Asheville, North Carolina, he said there's already a local cider there that is absolutely stunning. It's on tap only, and they don't bottle it yet, but he said it is nothing short of yummy. The pink K, pinkish red K cider coming out of the UK. He describes as having a gorgeous flavor and like 8%+ alcohol. David closes saying, "Yeah, buddy."
Right on.
So you know we can, or you know you can just go buy your Budweiser. but why would you when there's so much there's so much out there to enjoy?
Right. You know if some people again. Just don't have the options, and sometimes it's, you know, it's such a money factor so often.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you're going with the corporate beers, I think Miller is union made, I'm not sure.
Well, none of them are American owned anymore, so. But,
okay.
But I think, Miller and Bud are, Miller is most definitely union, and it's still, a lot of it's still coming out of what I think of as Beer Central, namely, you know, Wisconsin. I've still got a bottle of Belgian style Lambic that I brought back last summer from a stop in Wisconsin that I'm waiting for just the right moment to do all the wrong things, i.e., drink when the weather is warm and the sun is the weather's nice and the sun's warm and there's no clouds in the sky and everything in the world just says, "Bob, open that thing." It's in a 750 milliliter champagne type bottle with a cork in it and red wax melted over it. Yeah, it won't make it through this summer.
Yeah. And speaking, kind of related to sustainable business or work to be done, have you caught the program American Weed by chance? It's on the National Geographic Channel.
Don't get the channel.
Okay. It's pretty fascinating, and it's kind of close to my heart in a lot of ways because, you know, we're breaking out of that mold of we're going to treat marijuana like a criminal, and anyone associated with it is going to be harassed and lose jobs and all that stuff. You know, the new Jim Crow laws.
Right.
Here in Colorado, we've amazingly, we've changed the laws, and we've got all these dispensaries. And this show on National Geographic focuses on Fort Collins, which is where I went to school, Colorado State.
Go Rams.
Yep. And these five brothers who both grow cannabis, and they have a dispensary in Fort Collins. And last fall, a big effort was, a campaign was started to close down the dispensaries in Fort Collins. And they got ahead of it. You know, they started the movement, and the dispensary people and the patients were kind of behind it, behind the ball. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone. Actually, last night was the episode where they lost the vote, and they chose to ban these dispensaries.
Oh.
So all these businesses done, the people who worked as cashiers, they had this woman, I forget her ailment. It wasn't cancer, but they had cancer patients. They had guys in wheelchairs, and they found relief. I mean, again, what great work to reduce suffering. That's noble work. You know, and certainly some people, they get their licenses because they just find it enjoyable. And that's great. You know, if people can use this license system to provide a cover for themselves to avoid jail or avoid having to deal with people you may not know in a dark alley, that whole, to get beyond that, that is progress. But anyway, the American Weed, one of the patients is like this 60-year-old mom, excruciating back pain, and so she was devastated by this loss. But I think ultimately there are going to be a lot of setbacks like this, but I think ultimately
well, consider the distance traveled from the point of origin, and you get a sense for the progress made.
Yeah. And I agree. West Virginia could use a lot of jobs. Like we have like 3,000 jobs created in Denver alone.
Yeah, but see, because of that new mine safety bill that we just passed here in West Virginia, that focuses almost all of its efforts on PP testing the coal miners instead of focusing on profiteering coal companies that don't give a damn whether miners live or die.
Mm-hmm.
See, if we got medical marijuana here in West Virginia, the coal industry would disappear.
Look, that's another aspect of this war on cannabis that's so pernicious and so unjust. You know, if they test your pee and they find cannabis in your system and it could have been there from a month ago or whatever, oh, sorry, we're not going to pay that claim. Can't get your unemployment insurance. Too bad.
Now right.
They're testing all these welfare recipients for...
Well, meanwhile, you could, on the other hand, pop a little hit of blotter into your mouth, walk into the mine, you know, watching snakes come grow out of the coal seam and stuff, and they can test your pee all day long, Preston,
and
they ain't gonna find nothing.
And they're not testing for the accepted dope, the official dope. You know, whether it's beer. Sometimes they do some, but you can do that.
Well, I mean, they're testing because Appalachia is on fire with illicit narcotics trade.
Yeah.
That's what they're, you know, they're going to go after marijuana, cannabis, and they're hot to find meth and crack and you know, Lortab, Vicodin, you know, your basic hydrocodone usual suspects.
You can have Zoloft, right?
Oh, but you can have Zoloft. Yeah.
And
lorazepam, clonazepam, diazepam. You could,
and this is a very difficult subject to discuss in some ways because I have friends and people I just kind of, you know, a variety of people I know who have found, again, they've reduced their own suffering through pharmaceuticals sometimes, and more power to them, and I hope it continues to be successful and helpful. On the other hand, though, we have to be able to critique this industry, and it's a huge, I think it's the most profitable industry in the world, big pharma. And some of this stuff and some of the techniques they're using to push this stuff is really grotesque in their prescribing.
Bordering on criminal.
That's right. And again, the alternatives are being shunted aside, being totally marginalized. Things like talk therapy or things like looking at your social economic circumstance. You know, don't look at that. It's brain chemicals. You've got an imbalanced brain.
Right. You've got a bad brain, not a bad life.
You're not unjust society. And there are, you know, people, poor people, at times kids, especially now, more and more being pressured, being put on Ritalin. I read an interview in The Sun with a critic of the industry and talked about some of the potential political effects of some of the pharmaceuticals. He suggests there's an emotional blunting that's developed through these things. And instead of us being angry or being afraid or being anything regarding mountaintops being blown up or tar sand, boreal forest being ripped down, that these drugs are kind of making us, whatever. That kind of emotional blunt going on. Not always. Again, I know people are on them and they're functional, wonderful, passionate people.
Well, they're functional, wonderful, passionate heroin addicts. You know, the problem is not necessarily the addiction. Right. The problem lies in the prohibition.
Right. And they also the addictive qualities in the very small print, but they tend not to talk about it much. Zoloft and stuff like that can be very addictive in the getting off of it process.
Right, but they can advertise it on TV as being the same. A person who needs Zoloft is a sad egg, and then you take your Zoloft and you become a happy egg.
Is that what it is? Like an egg bouncing around?
Yeah, remember the little egg? Yeah, that was Zoloft.
I saw.
Be a happy egg. Take Zoloft.
Yeah, I kind of saw an anti-ad kind of parody of that egg.
I think I saw that too. By the way, I got to throw this in since we did have the dandelion discussion and we're running up against the end.
Okay.
Our buddy Jay wrote in a little bit ago pointing out that dandelions, which are so healthy, are the most widely distributed plant on the entire planet. They're found on every part of our world. They grow from the tops of 20,000-foot mountains to the banks of the Dead Sea. And yet there is an entire industry dedicated to creating poisons that you put on your yard to make those lovely little yellow flowers that make little girls so happy and little boys so happy. Yeah, we got to kill them. They got to die.
Again, it's like that process, that dynamic of creating enemies and then war being a racket, go after the enemy. It's this perpetual war again. But you can't keep a good weed down, apparently, and they're still there for us, and we should be there for them. And one quick final note, let's not let them take the word sequester from us either. You know, the coal industry is pushing clean coal, so-called, and we're going to sequester the CO2. No, they're not. But anyway, there can be real sequestration going on, and I think it's going to involve the weeds and the native grasses. And planting more trees, we can sequester some of this carbon that's been put out there.
Indeed. So, Preston, I got to get out of here, but what a magnificent conversation this has been. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, totally. We'll talk again soon.
All right, have a wonderful evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The Horn's resident optimist, that's our good friend Preston calling from Denver. Time to get out of here. Where did the show go? This one, like, started 10 minutes ago and it's over. That's, I feel energized. And that's wonderful when it happens that way. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. You who contribute to keep the bills paid. All of our you offer your thoughts, your commentary, your phone calls, your chat room participation, your emails. And just the time that you spend with us is magic. And it is sublimely appreciated. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff.
Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there, learn about the work of Coal River Mountain Watch. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next, only on the Horn.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here, it's Thorn in the Side Thursday, a minute and a half past the hour. It is the 22nd day of March. March is going away in a hurry. In a hot hurry, I might add. For it is another beautiful day in what was left of Appalachia. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice, headonradionetwork.com. We call what we do here conversation radio. Stick around for a few shows, and I guarantee you'll understand why. And this particular day, Thorn in the Side Thursday, as named by our good buddy Horst several months back, is reserved for things that make us want to scream a little bit more loudly. So we have to start that way. But there is, as ever, a ton of stuff, more stuff than we've got 3 hours to go into.